Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's trip to Africa, where before heading to Tanzania and on to South Africa on Friday, today in Senegal he visited the departure point for thousands of slaves who were taken to the New World. Deborah Bradigam, the author of The Dragon's Gift, The Real Story of China in Africa, joins us to discuss the subtext of Obama's trip in terms of U.S. and Chinese competition on the continent for influence and resources. Then we will speak with an energy insider who is a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. We will discuss President Obama's recent speech on addressing the challenge of climate change, where Obama said America would take the lead and redouble its efforts to assault global warming by phasing out coal plants and switching to natural gas, which our guest David Freeman considers is going from bad to bad. Then finally, with the President saying that there would be no wheeling and dealing to try to extradite Edward Snowden from Russia, we will discuss the extent to which the former employee with a contractor for the National Security Agency who is on the run fits the definition of a whistleblower. Kathleen McClellan, the National Security and Human Rights Counsel at the Government Accountability Project, where she supports national security and intelligence community whistleblowers, joins us to discuss the fugitive Americans' limited options. And joining us now is Deborah Bradigam, who is a professor and director of the International Development Policy at Johns Hopkins University and a visiting professor at the University of Bergen in Norway. She's the author of The Dragon's Gift, The Real Story of China in Africa. Welcome to Background Briefing, Deborah Bradigam.
Thanks, Ian. It's great to be back.
And apparently the subtext of President Obama's trip to Africa is that he's sort of trying to put an American face on that continent because of Chinese influence. At least that's what we're told, that this is really a competition between the United States and China for influence on that continent. Is it that simple?
I don't think it's that simple even. Every American president in recent years has gone to Africa on a major trip at one point or another, and Obama didn't do that in his first term. He had a very short trip to Ghana, but this is his, quote, major trip to Africa. So it's late. In that sense, people are looking at this, particularly because the new president of China, Xi Jinping, went to Africa on his very first visit as president. So people are framing this as Obama catching up to China, but I don't really see it that way, and I'm sure the administration is viewing this as a much more complex trip than just U.S., China, and Africa.
Well, he's going to three countries. He's in Senegal, and today, Thursday, he visited Gouray Island, where the slave ships came in and took the slaves, millions, to the New World. Then he's on to Tanzania, and then on Friday, he'll be in South Africa. And there's a sense that in many ways, whether or not he'll see Nelson Mandela seems to be in the balance. South African press have been very critical of the Mandela family for trying to keep him alive. I'm wondering whether it could be about the visit. What's your understanding about whether or not the president wants to visit Mandela?
I think it would be surprising if Mandela were in a better frame of health and he didn't meet with the president. But given that he's basically on his deathbed in South Africa, I think a meeting between the president and former President Mandela would be quite surprising. This is a time I think that Mandela probably wants to be with his family. And I can't imagine it's a great photo op either.
Well, let's talk about how U.S. politics are intruding. In his press conference in Senegal, the president, of course, was asked about the Supreme Court rulings on striking down DOMA and the appeal on Prop 8. And it was a little embarrassing for the Senegalese leader because, you know, in most of Africa is fairly homophobic, is it not? Although the Senegalese say they're not homophobic, but certainly there's no way in the world that gay marriage is possible in Senegal.
I think that on the whole, across the continent, you don't have a very progressive attitude toward gay rights. And certainly gay marriage is not something that's really accepted pretty much anywhere. Perhaps it is in South Africa, which has a much more progressive attitude towards human rights than most parts of the continent. So I think it is a conflict. Of course, this is a movement that's come fairly rapidly, if you think in historic terms in the United States. 30 years ago, we weren't there either. So this is something that's only beginning to even become a subject that's in the newspapers and that is in people's consciousness in Africa. And we can see there's been some real backlash against it, for example, in Uganda, where people were facing the death penalty for their sexuality, for crimes related to this, according to the statutes in Uganda. Of course, President Obama is not visiting Uganda, fortunately.
No, and apparently a lot of that anti-homosexual, those punitive laws in Uganda have been encouraged by conservative American Christians. At least that's some of the stories I've read.
Well, that's true. It's quite unfortunate.
So Obama, of course, is not visiting Kenya. And, of course, there's a number of Americans who think he's from Kenya, that he's an imposter with a phony birth certificate. But I imagine it's embarrassing and impossible to visit a country whose head of state is wanted by the International Criminal Court for running death squads, stirring up tribal bloodshed.
I'm sure there was no question at all of him going to Kenya on this visit. And there won't be an Obama visit to Kenya as long as their leadership is wanted by the ICC, the International Criminal Court.
I think the slave angle was, I think, quite powerful, even though it was not brought up today at Gure Island. It seems a bit of an irony that the president is visiting where the slaves were taken aboard ships and shipped to America and Brazil and other countries from that point. And then yesterday, or the day before yesterday, the Supreme Court struck down a key pillar of the civil rights movement, legislation resulting from the civil rights movement, the Voting Rights Act. So I'm making that connection. The president didn't. But is there some symbolism there?
I think that it's actually the going to Tanzania really, of course, doesn't have much symbolism. Going to Gore Island in Senegal, of course, one can make that link between the civil rights movement and those past centuries of slavery. But this trip was planned far before the administration had any idea what was going to happen at Supreme Court. It is striking, of course, to look and see how far we've gone and how far we have yet to go.
Again, I'm speaking with Deborah Brannigan, who is a professor and director of the International Development Program at Johns Hopkins University and a visiting professor at the University of Bergen in Norway. She's the author of The Dragon's Gift, The Real Story of China in Africa. So in terms of the Chinese-U.S. competition for resources in Africa, and of course the colonial history of Africa is pretty much all about the Europeans plundering the place, isn't it? Is it not? So how much plundering is going on now? I know, for example, southern Sudan, huge tracts of land are being bought up. You're saying that Tanzania may have a lot of natural gas. So in terms of the competition, in terms of who is the more enlightened in terms of exploitation, how does the U.S. and China rate in that regard? Because my understanding is there have been in Zambia and other countries where Chinese overlords have mines and stuff, there's been some pretty racist treatment of Africans and cases where mine owners or managers have shot African workers on strike.
That did happen in Zambia. And I think it's interesting that when you think of all of the Chinese investments across Africa, we just have that one example where there was this really heinous treatment. This is a private Chinese company. It's since been closed down by the government in Zambia, and quite rightly. And this is dreadful behavior. And the two mine managers that did shoot at the striking workers, who they said they did it out of self-defense because the workers were rushing at them. And there had been a history of two Chinese being killed at that mine by workers. So there was a heightened degree of violence there, a heightened degree of fear on everybody's part, and it's a good thing that the mine was shut down. I don't think that kind of activity is consistent or common across the continent, and that's why everyone keeps coming back to that one example, because it's the only example that we've really seen. And one can always parallel this kind of Chinese example with, for example, the Marikana mine killings in South Africa. This is a British mine, and the miners
was not the managers that shot at the miners, but the miners who were attacking each other, and then the South African police that killed about 25 miners. So this is another example of violence in a mineral resource sector with a British mine. So these kinds of examples of fear, of attacking, it's one of the most extreme examples of capital and labor conflicts that you find in this mineral sector. And we can see it even in our own country. Safety issues, strikes in mines, we have a long history of that in America, and a long history of mine safety violations by American mine owners. So these are problems that are sort of common across this sector. Now, I don't think the Chinese are the best in Africa by a long shot. I don't think they're as bad as they commonly seem in the headlines either. So I think their safety standards are low. They aren't as good as American standards or other European standards. But if you look carefully, even in Zambia, and there have been other studies that have looked at the mines in Zambia, there is not a very big difference between the big Chinese state-owned mines and the big Indian mines, and even some of the big mines that are run by Canadians and Swiss investors in Zambia. Their safety standards, their injury rates, the fatalities at those mines are all quite similar.
And, of course, in South Africa, which is now run by the majority black government, there was an outrageous shooting of miners on strike not so long ago. So,
yeah, so that's in Marikana.
Yeah, exactly.
The Marikana mine strike.
Yeah, you mentioned that, I know. So how does the U.S. do in terms of human rights versus getting access to resources? Because you mentioned that, Deborah Bradigan, that the president's visiting three relatively model democracies in Africa, but we know a lot of Africa has been run by despots and kleptocrats. And no greater example of that is in Equatorial Guinea, which is incredibly rich in oil, but run by a really psychotic kleptocrat. And his son was living out here in Malibu in, you know, several hundred million dollar splendor. So what's happening there in terms of the U.S. oil companies that are continuing to pump oil there? Is that just something that we don't like to talk about?
I think it is, Ian. I think the United States and certainly the administration would like to portray U.S. and U.S. investors as always being on the side of human rights and always being on the side of good governance. And I think we've improved a lot. I think companies can be named and shamed for their investments, and banks, U.S. banks that engage in money laundering for African dictators like Riggs Bank, or I should say the former Riggs Bank in Washington, was shut down because of the money laundering it engaged in. And that did involve the dictator in Equatorial Guinea. So I think that we are improving and we are taking those kinds of things into consideration, but that's not going to stop us when it comes to really lucrative investments. There's really only one case in which the United States has put investment sanctions on a country, and that's Sudan. So if you look at these other cases, Equatorial Guinea, Angola, places where governance has been very problematic, Zimbabwe, one can mention as well, there are no sanctions on investment. So we have American investors in Zimbabwe. We've got them in Angola, Nigeria, all during the periods of dictatorship, and other places. So they do go in there. They're in Algeria, for example, hardly a democratic country. And we were big investors in Egypt all up until the Arab Spring, and that was a dictatorship as well. So we do not take these kinds of considerations into they're not first and foremost in our minds when we're making investment decisions as companies. So that's unfortunate. It's also the case, of course, for the Chinese.
So, Deborah Bradigan, what do you think then the president will be talking about in this major address that he's scheduled to give on Sunday at the University of Cape Town?
I hope he's going to be talking about Africa on the rise, because there's a lot of attention to that. It's a hopeful situation. There are a lot of young people in Africa who need jobs, and I hope he'll be talking about how the United States can help in employment generation in Africa. We've been, I think, a big friend of Africa on the health side. We've provided a lot of antiretrovirals. We've kept a lot of Africans alive. But we really haven't done much as a nation for job creation. A lot of the areas where we invest are in the natural resources sector, and that doesn't generate a lot of jobs. And ironically, people believe that the Chinese have been bringing in all of their own workers and not creating jobs either. But that's actually not the case. There's been a lot of Chinese investment in sectors like manufacturing. There's a factory that I visited in Ethiopia, for example, and they're approaching 2,000 Ethiopians in employment at that one factory, and there are other factories in the leather sector coming from China. So this is something that the Chinese are interested in. The Indians are going into that area. They're generating jobs in manufacturing, which is really where Africa needs to move if it's going to start moving up the value chain. They need to add value to their own products. So I hope that Obama will talk more about how the United States might be helping to create incentives. I rather doubt that, because that would be a big leap for us to be moving into helping American companies move manufacturing to Africa. It's a very sensitive issue for the United States. But I hope we'll be talking about how the United States might shift some of our funding into things like infrastructure, because right now the cost of production in Africa is very high because infrastructure is very bad. And so this makes all of the transport, electricity, every factory has to have an extra generator in order to ensure that they have enough power to keep going. So these add to the cost. So these kinds of things, I think, that I hope that Obama will talk about this. And he might talk about how public-private partnerships can be fostered in Africa and that America could get on board more with this kind of engagement. So the United States needs more instruments in order to make these kinds of things happen. We need more money in OPEC. We need more money in the Exim Bank. Not just foreign aid money, but money to make business engagement happen. And I think Africans are really, they like the foreign aid, but they really want the investment. They want that kind of business engagement. And that's what they're getting from China. So I think this is really something that's quite welcome.
Well, just in closing, Deborah Brannigan, again, the author of Dragon's Gift, The Real Story of China in Africa, it sounds in many ways that the real story of China in Africa might be that it has actually acted as an incentive for the U.S. and other European countries to perhaps engage in better business practices. If you're saying that the Chinese, in spite of the example of Zambia in the mine there, they're doing quite well in other places and employing people. So have the Chinese actually stimulated us to do better? Is that what you're saying?
I don't think the Chinese have stimulated us to do better in terms of our approach to things like human rights and safety, good governance. I think that kind of stimulus was already in place before the Chinese became a big factor in Africa. But I think where they're stimulating us is in the perception of Africa. And there is a general, there has been a general idea in Europe and the United States that Africa is a place of chaos and pathos and starving children and wars, child soldiers, and so on. And the Chinese have not looked at that. They've looked at Africa, and they've said, this is a place where we can do business. And now other countries and other parts of the world are looking at Africa with new eyes. And I think that's what the Chinese have done. They've said that Africa is open for business. The Africans have been saying it. The Chinese have been doing business. And now others are going there, and they're saying, I think we're falling behind in terms of Africa as a business location, as a place for investment.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Deborah Brannigan.
You're very welcome, Ian. It's good to talk to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Deborah Brannigan, who's a professor and director of the International Development Program at Johns Hopkins University and a visiting professor at the University of Bergen in Norway. She's the author of The Dragon's Gift, The Real Story of China in Africa. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about President Obama's recent speech on assaulting global warming.
Nenua,